Good morning. You are listening to KGNU, Boulder, Denver, with translators K229AC Nederland, K254CH LaPorte, and K256CT Denver, Colorado. It's 8:04 on a beautiful morning. You're tuned to Community Radio. I'm Eric Skase, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, as we continue our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic, we'll hear why some people are hoarding goods, despite assurances that we won't run out of food or toilet paper. Then, with the announcement on Friday evening that the Rocky Mountain National Park will close indefinitely, we'll hear how a community close to another national park is trying to discourage visitors from flocking to the area. The State of Alzheimer's Report was recently released. We'll hear what it said from the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association of Colorado. And after headlines from the BBC and a new commentary from Jim Hightower, it's time for A Public Affair. This morning, we'll revisit a show from last August hosted by the Community Foundation of Boulder County looking at education. At 9 o'clock, it's media analysis from Counterspin rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, the local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Yesterday, Colorado Governor Jared Polis ordered employers in non-critical workplaces to cut their in-person workforces by at least 50%. The governor said that thousands of Coloradans are likely to have the illness, and it's just a matter of time before there are positive cases in all of the state's 64 counties. From the podium in the state's Emergency Operations Center, Polis urged residents to go to the grocery stores less frequently, reducing visits to once a week, if not once a month. State officials have said that grocery stores will increasingly be stocked. Polis also said that people should consider going outside to jog or walk less often and during less crowded times so they stay away from others. Polis stopped short of issuing an order for people to shelter in place, as has been done in California and three other states. He said that such orders cannot be enforced, and slowing the spread of the virus will require greater motivation than the threat of arrest. He said that there is a far greater enforcement authority. His name is the Grim Reaper. Polis's order directs all employers to implement telework options to the greatest extent possible. While state agencies plan to meet this requirement today, private companies must start tomorrow and continue through April 10th. Workplaces that are deemed critical are exempt. Those include, among others, healthcare, utilities, grocery stores, news organizations, and financial operations. The governor also exempted workplaces where employers ensure 6-foot spacing between employees. Governor Polis said that due to the failed federal response to the public health crisis, the states will be taking on an unprecedented burden. He added that the ideal response would have been to have mass testing in place months ago. Polis said that if we do not do more to slow the spread, the hospital system will be overwhelmed. The Denver Post reports that Colorado currently lacks 7,000 ventilators and sufficient hospital beds that will be necessary during an anticipated surge in the number of cases. The Army Corps of Engineers has arrived in Colorado, as in other states, but it is unclear whether they would be deployed to construct hospital space as they are doing elsewhere. Over the weekend, the number of new cases in the state increased by 228, with the total number close to 600. More than 5,500 have been tested. As of yesterday afternoon, 7 people had died from the virus in Colorado. Among those who have tested positive are a lawyer who visited multiple courtrooms in Denver's Lindsay Flanagan Courthouse recently. The entire courthouse will be closed today and tomorrow for cleaning, with all hearings scheduled this week in Denver District Court suspended. Officials reported yesterday that there are 38 confirmed cases in Boulder County, which is up 2 cases from late Saturday. In an email to the Daily Camera, Shana Gusettis, a county spokesperson, said that there are 17 residents isolating at home and an additional person has recovered from the disease. But like state officials, those in Boulder County are saying that the number of confirmed cases probably does not fully reflect the actual number of those who have the virus. In Denver, there is a need for rooms to shelter people experiencing homelessness and others who do not have a place to go as they await test results or show symptoms of the virus. The need for rooms could be as high as 4,000, according to the Denver Post. Denver's chief housing officer said that local property owners and managers hold the keys. The city has properties that can house groups, but not individuals, under quarantine or isolation orders. The rooms are needed to relieve hospitals, which already face a shortage of beds, and to prevent spread of the virus in homeless shelters and public spaces. cases. Shelters are not well positioned for social distancing, and those experiencing homelessness are more likely to suffer from underlying health issues. While most people who are treated in hospitals can go home to recover, some do not have a housing option. Among events that have been canceled or postponed, the Boulder has been put off until Labor Day from its usual Memorial Day running, and town officials in Estes Park have ordered the closing of all hotels, motels, and vacation rentals. The move follows the closing of Rocky Mountain National Park last week. Meanwhile, U.S. Attorney General William Barr has directed the top federal prosecutor in Colorado to investigate and prosecute any fraud related to the coronavirus in the state. Jason Dunn, the U.S. Attorney for Colorado, has outlined several schemes, including the sale of fake cures online and phishing emails posing as the World Health Organization or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yesterday, in response to a shortage of personal protective equipment, or PPE, for the state's medical professionals, a donation drive was held in the parking lot of Empower Field in Denver. The Denver Channel reports that the effort came together in a couple of days with the help of state legislators and local nonprofits. Project Cure President Douglas Jackson said that every day they are getting requests from hospitals and fire departments saying that they are running out of gloves and masks and PPE. In today's weather, it will be mostly sunny with a high near 54, but there is a chance of showers this afternoon and into this evening. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 61 and gusty winds. Right now, it's about 34 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Thank you, Jamie. You're listening to Community Radio. I'm Eric Skase. Since the new coronavirus was acknowledged as a serious health threat, we've all seen photos and read stories about people panic buying certain items, especially toilet paper. While there's no reason to believe the U.S. supply chain of products or food will halt due to the pandemic, the hoarding continues. KGNU's Roz Brown talked to a psychologist to find out why.
For whatever reason, given what has happened to them, given their health, their physical, their psychological health, where they are in the moment, many people are just more prone to stress at particular situations.
That's Baruch Viskoff, a psychologist and professor in the Department of Engineering and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He says an absence of early communication about COVID-19 left some people without confidence that the supply chain would remain intact. He adds, in this type of situation, some of us feel more vulnerable than others.
You go to the store to buy the essentials that you will need. And if you don't find the food that you usually like, there is other food that you can buy. But there really is no substitute for toilet paper.
The government has assured Americans there's no reason to believe the U.S. supply chain of products or food will halt due to the pandemic. But many store shelves are empty of certain goods, so the hoarding continues, especially toilet paper.
Once they're in the store and there's some group dynamics and people are under stress, then you will find some people behaving impolitely.
In his view, hoarding or even panic buying are not accurate descriptions.
I mean, hoarding is a bad term. Panic buying is a bad term because this deliberate reflective behavior for people who, are trying to be responsible. And the whole story leaves out the people who don't have the money, the transportation, the physical strength to get the things that they need.
Viskoff says another thing controlling people's behavior during this time is how much television they watch.
The explanation for that is that television is very good at grabbing your emotions and keeping you watching past the next commercial. It doesn't deliver a lot of information, and as a result, people are continually riled. People want to learn more, but the information in these situations is coming out fairly slowly. You'd be able to shut down the information flow and the search for information that isn't there. So there are people who are working you and you don't want to expose yourselves to them.
Viskoff also reminds us that social media is not always an ally.
Social media are good for seeing how your friends are dealing, learning for creative solutions to problems, providing support to one another. But it's also a source of wild notions and conspiracies. And one thing we know from the research is that people are very good at making sense of anything. So you can read a conspiracy theory. You don't trust the source. You know it's crazy, but there's a part of your mind says, well, I wonder how. Gee, maybe. Once you've got that bit of thinking in your mind, it's hard to get it out. So it's important to get ourselves through this period not to be distracted by things that will not do us any good.
Fiskoff says ramped up purchases have also likely been exacerbated because there's no knowing when the directive to self-isolate will end.
So sometimes very thoughtful decisions run into bad luck, and sometimes very thoughtful decisions involve making the best of a bad situation. So if we've done all we could in terms of getting information, in terms of being creative about solutions, and then have made a reasoned decision, then we can hope for the best, but we shouldn't add the insult of regret to whatever injury befalls us.
For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
On Friday evening, the Rocky Mountain National Park closed to visitors. The decision came after a plea from the mayor of Estes Park to federal officials saying gateway communities are at risk from visitors coming to recreate. Another gateway community, Moab, Utah, is also sending out a message that it is closed to visitors. Health officials issued an order last week to shut down the area's hotels and camping areas to visitors. KZMU's Molly Marcello reports.
Health officials made several firm decisions to slow the spread of novel coronavirus in a region that sees heavy use from visitors around the world.
As of now, there are to be no new check-ins.
Orion Rogers, Southeastern Utah's environmental health director. Currently, the only people allowed to stay in Moab's hotels and campgrounds are primary residents and, quote, essential visitors, those who are in the region for work.
Essential visitors are people that are coming here and need a place to stay, and they are providing a service to our community by doing some form of work here.
In addition to a 30-day restriction on recreational visitation, Moab's dine-in restaurants are also ordered to shut their doors, leaving curbside and takeout options for now.
I mean, it's a really hard time, and everyone can agree, and this is like the worst timing ever. And coming out of winter, being stoked about just hiring and getting staff in place.
Natalie Zollinger manages popular Moab Eatery 98 Center. In the past few days, the restaurant took decisive action to halt their table service, but they now face a full closure.
And it's a really hard move because that means we're officially closing the doors and there's no money coming in and all of our bills are due. So it's hard. It's very emotional right now, like 100%.
Local business owners wrestled with an impossible dilemma the last few weeks. How do you keep food on the table for your employees while keeping them safe from a global pandemic? Lisa Bose is the resort manager at Moab Springs Ranch.
My quandary was being a citizen here and wanting to protect our town and our resources from the influx, yet managing a resort where our livelihood and our entire business is at stake.
But Southeastern Utah health officials eventually answered that tough question. As they drew up orders to shutter the region to most outsiders, they were staring down the barrel of a busy spring season. Tourists continued to pour into Moab's hotels, restaurants, and natural playgrounds. That made Moab Regional Hospital CEO Jen Sadoff very nervous.
This is a time for all of us, you know, not just Moab to work at social distancing, but for all of us.
Sadoff and her top hospital staff say flatly that Moab's rural infrastructure absolutely cannot handle a large outbreak of COVID-19. She's desperate to avoid the fate of countries like Italy, where right now the number of patients exceed the capacity of healthcare services.
Just like there's not enough rolls of toilet paper right now because everybody went running for toilet paper. If everybody comes running for healthcare services, there's just no way to ramp those up to meet the need.
Health officials hope to avoid that situation by taking these precautionary measures. As the signs popping up all over downtown businesses say, Moab is closed for now. Reporting from Moab, Utah, I'm Molly Marcello.
You are listening to Morning Magazine here on your community radio station, KGNU. We'll be right back.
This program is made possible by you, the KGNU listener member, and by Fisk Planetarium on the CU Boulder campus, striving to blow your mind with our visually stunning liquid sky and laser music shows for 40 years. More information at colorado.edu/Fisk or by calling 303-492-5002.
Earlier this month, the annual State of Alzheimer's Disease Report was released. KGNU's Maeve Conran spoke with Amelia Schaefer, the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association of Colorado.
Unfortunately, the number of people living with Alzheimer's and dementia in Colorado is at an all-time high. We saw a 4% increase from 2019 to 2020, and unfortunately, that trajectory looks to be on track to reach 92,000 people in the next 5 years. And so for us, that is our sense of urgency to, as we are fighting for a cure, to ensure that we are taking care of people today.
Well, I know as part of this report that's being released this week is that you're really taking a look at primary care physicians and Alzheimer's care in the US. Why primary care physicians as opposed to specialists or gerontologists?
Yeah, well, we know that primary care physicians are really the front lines. Most of us have a primary care physician. That's who we go see. Certainly in Colorado, a lot of our terrain is rural Colorado, and so we don't have a lot of specialists out there in rural Colorado. But even here in the Denver metro area or any of our metro areas, we know that primary care physicians are really burdening. We know that in even our metro areas, primary care physicians are bearing the brunt of most Alzheimer's care.
And do you feel that they are equipped to A, recognize the symptoms, and B, then provide support for not just the patient, but the family?
Yeah, there's some fantastic primary care physicians out there, but even primary care physicians don't feel prepared. In fact, 2 out of 5, in a recent survey, 2 out of 5 said that they never or are only sometimes comfortable making an Alzheimer's diagnosis. So if that's true of primary care physicians, then the question is, how can we find a geriatrician or an Alzheimer's specialist? And we absolutely know we don't have enough of those here in Colorado.
I know part of the report is taking a look at the economics of all of this, because, of course, Alzheimer's or dementia, different forms of dementia, can have a devastating impact when a person gets that diagnosis, and then that ripple effect into the family and caregivers. But that also translates to a massive economic factor too. And we'll talk about the economic burden, I suppose, or the cost to society if we look at Medicare, Medicaid reimbursements. But really, if you look at how it impacts families and caregivers who are very often forced to give up a job and therefore denied of an income. I know that your report is trying to put some figures on that to give people a real sense of what's going on.
Sure. Well, Alzheimer's is one of the costliest diseases to care for. One reason is because it lasts so long. Another reason is because people progressively need more help. And so last year, our country spent $290 billion caring for people with Alzheimer's and dementia. Much of that was from family caregivers who either had to quit a job, move to part-time, or reduce their hours because they needed to be there to take care of folks. I think there is still this misconception that Medicare or Medicaid or some sort of state aid will help individuals care for people. But the truth is, much of that falls to family caregivers. We know this, that eventually in Alzheimer's and most other dementias, people will need a full-time caregiver. We also know that the majority of those folks don't get subsidies from Medicare or Medicaid for that full-time care. And so it really is up to individual families to look at their situation and say, what do we do? How do we take care of mom? How do we take care of dad? And it often falls to them.
And of course, the ripple effect of that, if many people give up their jobs, they're also giving up their own health insurance and their own health care. So there's an extra burden on caregivers.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things we know is that Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers are often the most burdened and face the most caregiver burnout. And so what we see in them is that they're not taking care of their own health. And unfortunately, sometimes that means that they're actually in need of a caregiver. And the challenge on that is then that the extended family has to figure out, you know, dad's been taking care of mom, and now we need to take care of both dad and mom. And so the impact on working families is challenging. Imagine the impact on people who don't necessarily have a family. And so that then falls to our society. And, you know, what happens is it's always too little too late. You know, we've already talked about the shortage of geriatricians here in Colorado and in our country. We've talked about primary care physicians not feeling comfortable or confident in diagnosing and taking care of individuals. And so what ends up happening is a crisis usually. We wait until a crisis occurs, and then none of us make our best decisions in a crisis. So that's what we're really trying to prevent here. And I think, Maeve, for your listeners to understand that that's part of our mission is to educate people today, to make sure they know where to turn, to make sure they know about our helpline, about our education classes, to get the support they need. And because of the economics of it, everything we do is free of charge. We want to make sure that's not a barrier for individuals to get the kind of support that we know they need.
Well, in addition to this report, I know that the Alzheimer's Association is also involved in sort of advocating and advocacy work around policy. What needs to be put in place for society at a federal level, at a state level? What could be put in place to mitigate some of these impacts?
Yeah, we are very active both at the state and federal level looking at several things. First, we know that Alzheimer's research needs more funding. We've been lucky in the past few years to be getting additional funding, but it doesn't even come close to that $290 billion number that I mentioned earlier. So we know that more Alzheimer's research funding hopefully will pay off in the long run by giving us some solutions and hopefully our first treatment, which we still don't have yet. We also know that Alzheimer's and dementia families need help today. So they need help with policies around family medical leave. They need help with policies around caring for people in a care setting, ensuring that assisted living and nursing homes and home care have adequate training so they can take good care and be good care partners to these families on their journey, whether it be Alzheimer's or another form of dementia.
Well, I know the Alzheimer's Association has a wealth of resources available, and your website is a good place to start. That is alz.org/co. Amelia Schaefer, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much, Maeve.
And is there anything else you think people really need to be aware of or that you would like to convey?
I think the only other thing I would say is, like with any disease, early detection is so important, because if families don't know what they're dealing with, it's very difficult to make plans and to have the right resources in place. And so for us, it really is a matter of make sure that you are talking to your doctor. You can actually call our helpline and get a set of great questions to ask your doctor. If you see signs, every one of us should know the warning signs of Alzheimer's and dementia. And then we should be able to take that to our medical professional and let them know that we're seeing these signs either in ourselves or in someone we love. And that is really what's going to bridge some of that gap of diagnosis and detection.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much, Amelia. And I don't want to, swath everything in context of the coronavirus, but, I'm talking, it's impacting everybody. And I would imagine that there are families who are really concerned, because dementia, it's not only seniors, but very often it is people who are elderly who are dealing with this. Are you fielding calls? Are people being concerned about how the coronavirus maybe impacts their loved ones?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly are, that's on our radar, and we are getting questions from individuals asking, is there special care we should be providing? And I think one of the things we have to talk about is, washing hands is something we're certainly hearing in the media. Someone with Alzheimer's at a certain point in the disease will not know to wash their hands all the time. And so that alone, what's the hand washing protocol for the person you are caring for, whether they're in a care center or whether you're caring for them at home? Certainly that idea of limiting public outings is important, because just being able to recognize safety in someone with Alzheimer's and dementia is compromised. And so we have to be the eyes and ears for that person, much like the protocols we see around the country right now.
Another thing, though, that has really gotten me thinking as somebody who used to be a caregiver for an Alzheimer's patient, it's incredibly isolating in and of itself, just that experience. And as we're talking about people being isolated even more, I mean, this is a time maybe people can reach out if it's at least by phone or making a call or checking in through some other remote methods, to recognize that very often people are feeling isolated anyway. And when we have these times where we're being told to, even further avoid gathering in community, this could be, really tipping people over the edge who are already struggling.
That absolutely. And I think that there are a few resources. One certainly is our 24/7 helpline, where you can pick up a phone and call an Alzheimer's and dementia specialist anytime, any day. But another is our online chat rooms. Those are very active. We have caregivers, we have individuals living with early stage Alzheimer's and dementia who are on those. And those are actually a wonderful resource. You can find those on our website. I think the other thing is that as we are looking at not necessarily getting together in groups, this is where technology really comes into play. We have a lot of great resources online, as you said earlier. We have classes you can take online. We've got the chat room, and then certainly that 1-800 number, so you can reach out and talk to someone today.